Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Right now in the state of Louisiana, just to give you something that'll twist you up a little bit, 15,000 young men and women drop out of school, high school, every year, and 15,000 young men and women get put in prison every year. Now, there's a correlation between the two.
A lot of black-on-black crime has one to do with self-hatred. When you don't like yourself, I'll take another quote from Michael Jackson. It starts with the man in the mirror. When you don't like you, when you look in the mirror and you don't like what you see, then all of the psychology and psychiatrists tell you, you prone to hurt that which look like you.
The problem is the criminals are getting younger and younger. And, you know, so the kids are the criminals. And that's what made it so, you know, so crazy in De Niro's case, because he tried to make a difference in many kids' lives, and he was murdered by a 15-year-old child.
I mean, people coming home, going to their houses, and they still finding dead people in these houses, man. Just the other day, there were five people found in the attic of a house. Who knows? Somebody might be in there right now, laying under rubble. I mean, who is we to know that? But the military say they checked every house. This house here has iron bars on it. But they have numbers on the window as if it'd been checked.
De Niro was one of the founding members of the Hot 8 Brass Band. And shortly before he was murdered, he founded the first ever marching band at one of the high schools, Rob Wayne High School. I could remember when he was murdered, the kids, they called him their king, their father, and their friend. And he accomplished so much in his 25 years, and when he died, his murder was a result to the rise in crime that was taking place in New Orleans post-Katrina.
Investigators are looking for the gunman who killed teacher and Hot 8 Brass Band member De Niro Shavers. Investigators say they found him gunned down in the driver's seat of a car in Treme late this evening. He was rushed to the hospital.
My brother had just dropped his stepson off at a friend's house. Allegedly, the stepson had gotten into an argument with the neighborhood boys. My brother pulled up, he and his wife were in the car, and the stepson and his friend got into the car, and as he was pulling off, the shooter ran behind the car and fired two shots in the back window. And both shots struck De Niro in the head. He continued driving maybe four more blocks to get his family to safety while he was shot. And he drove until his foot slowly eased off the accelerator. And I was told the stepson and friend got out and ran, and the wife jumped out and was screaming. And a stranger came up and saw him laying on the ground.
We all are brothers, but he was like one of like really my closest brothers. You know, it's real hard every day, you know, just knowing that he's not here. You know, you couldn't see him, you couldn't touch him, you know, and I miss him a whole lot.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, October 30th, 2015. So I have been told. The audio clip at the beginning, Spike Lee's outstanding film, If God Is Willing and the Creek Don't Rise. Phenomenal effort. Effort came out 2010. The follow-up to When the Levees Broke. In that second segment, he's discussing De Niro Shavers. He will be brought up during the text this week. We are picking up Mr. Gary Rivlin's Katrina After the Flood. We are in the early portion of chapter 19, Darkness Revealed. Again, I can't give you the page numbers because I have the Kindle, but kind of the early portion of chapter 19. It's before the sisters have their discussion, if you will, about the state of the recovery in New Orleans East. With that, we will get to it. Gary Rivlin, Katrina, After the Flood, Context of White Supremacy, audio segment number one. The city council endorsed the UNOP process that Rockefeller and the other foundations were funding. So too did the mayor. That July, a citywide meeting was held for anyone wanting to learn more about UNOP. As if people weren't confused enough, Paul Lambert, the planner who had been hired by the city council, took out a full-page ad in the Times-Picayune imploring people not to waste their time talking to anyone from UNOP. Lambert's team continued to hold planning sessions around the city. They were in New Orleans East in mid-August, where they wowed a few hundred people showing up at the St. Maria Goretti Church. They showed sketches of the neighborhood populated by people enjoying the new jogging and biking paths that could be built and spoke of the world-class health care they could enjoy. They imagined sound barriers along the interstate and parks where there had been low-rent apartment buildings because, as one facilitator said, it's up to the community to decide where we put the green space. What he and his cohorts failed to tell the standing room only crowd, though, is that they were fulfilling a contract that had not been voided just because the city council had decided to throw in with a different set of planners. Kathleen Blanco had given everyone hope that February when she announced Road Home, the multi-billion dollar pot of money to help flooded homeowners whose insurance companies had left them short. A few weeks later, the Times-Picayune published the web address for applying for Road Home along with a telephone number. From that point on, virtually every article written about the lethargic pace of the New Orleans recovery mentioned Road Home and included an obligatory paragraph about the billions in federal housing aid that would be flowing into New Orleans. But first, HUD needed to endorse the state's plan, and not until June 2006 would the president authorize the money. When in August, 6 months after first announcing the program, Blanco was on Poydras to announce the opening of the city's first Road Home office, she blamed delays on government speed. The reporters descending on New Orleans around the time of the one-year anniversary were still stressing the potential of Road Home, optimistically imagining the billions in housing dollars that would hit the city that fall. At least a program was in place to help homeowners. Renters, though they constituted a majority in New Orleans, would be on their own. Rents had spiked 39% in the 12 months after Katrina, another hurdle for those of modest means anxious to get home. Most public housing units remained off limits, and the city's landlords didn't seem nearly as susceptible to the pioneer spirit galvanizing homeowners around the city. In communities thick with rental units, such as Central City and the 7th Ward, entire blocks sat untouched, rotting in the heat 12 months after Katrina, making them that much harder to restore. You drive around and you pretty much see nothing going on. It's depressing, said Henry Jones, who was living in a trailer in the east while he and his wife fixed up their home. An estimated 68,000 rental units were destroyed or heavily damaged by Katrina. The state was offering no-interest loans to anyone willing to fix up or build rentals in New Orleans, except those taking the money were permitted to charge market-rate rents. That would do little to help low- and moderate-income residents who wanted to move back to New Orleans. Those tenants looking for a below-market-rate unit signed up for federally subsidized Section 8 housing and hoped that one day their phone would ring. Early on, Alden McDonald had suggested using federal vouchers to foster home ownership and bring families home. Let a person qualifying for a Section 8 voucher, basically anyone earning under $10 an hour, pair up with a sibling or a parent or a grown-up child to purchase a two-family home. Then ease the rules so that the Section 8 recipient could use his or her monthly voucher to help cover the mortgage. But like everything else born under the Republic of the Bring New Orleans Back Commission, it was ignored. I'll confess to being frustrated, said Norman Francis, whom Blanco had put in charge of the Louisiana Recovery Authority. Without a plan, I don't see how we bring our low and moderate income renters back. To her surprise, Cassandra Wall began working on her old house. Eventually, they'd be moving home or selling the place. Either way, she figured it couldn't hurt to fix it up. Shortly after she started work, though, she discovered the home had been broken into. They stole every last copper pipe out of there, she said. Cassandra was still making regular trips to New Orleans. She visited her mother, who was sick with cancer, and made the long drive when her sisters tried to revive their tradition of Sunday night dinners. But she also felt the pull of her new life in Baton Rouge. She had found work teaching composition at a local community college and was making progress reviving her tutoring business. Her husband was having a hard time dealing with a job that meant a demotion in responsibility, and Katrina was taking a toll on Brandon. He was doing well in school, but he was looking at another school year in Baton Rouge rather than eighth grade back in New Orleans with his friends. You're fighting here. You're fighting there, Cassandra told her sisters. You realize you can't fight everyone and everywhere at once. That was her way of informing them that work on her old house would cease until further notice. Tangi was the first of Cassandra's sisters to move back into her home. She burned through most of her savings, but she was intent on showing the world that the East was coming back. Our community paid our taxes, she declared at around the one-year anniversary, with her home around 80% rebuilt. We pumped money into the economy. We deserve the right to return like any other part of New Orleans. On Saturdays, she ventured farther east to a meeting in the village Del East, a Vietnamese community coming back faster than other subdivisions in the area. A group of us decided to get behind this push for everyone in the East to pull together rather than it being a subdivision by subdivision thing, Tangi said. Father Vian the Wen hosted weekly meetings. Petit showed up at these meetings when she could, as did Robin. Petit was making progress on her place, but at a slower pace than Tangi. Room by room, Petit said, if not one wall at a time. Whenever she had the money, Petit would head to Lowe's, where day laborers, almost all of them Latino, lined up each day looking for work. You go saying you're looking for people to hang sheetrock and offer $100 a day, she said. And then, if they do a good job, you pay them more and keep them going to the next thing. 1 year after Katrina, she figured her home was about 40% rebuilt. Robin was back in New Orleans, but she hadn't done any work on her home. She was busy at work and didn't feel like competing for contractors, plumbers, and electricians. It was crazy, the prices people were asking, Robin said. I took my time because I could afford to. Once the lease expired on the condo she had rented in the warehouse district, she moved back to her mother's home in Broadmoor. Cassandra's sister, Contess, was still in Baton Rouge. Contess had gutted her home to preserve her investment, she said, but that was it. I'm not making up my mind, she announced, until the people in charge make up theirs. Tensions formed between the sisters. That was obvious 1 year after Katrina, when the five of them gathered at a crowded Barnes & Noble cafe in Metairie to talk about the recovery. That week, the Times-Picayune had run a page-one story declaring that without a major upgrade to the levee system, New Orleans East, sandwiched between Lake Bourne and Lake Pontchartrain, with Mr. Goh acting as an accelerant, would remain vulnerable. The article reinforced for Tangi the desire to fight for the East. But for Cassandra, it was another reason to wait until people in Washington had a chance to work things out. I'm not coming back until I know we have Category 5 protection, Cassandra said. We need a massive protest in Washington to make sure that happens, Tangi responded. It's our constitutional right to have our government protect us. The five of them agreed that life would not be easy for anyone choosing to rebuild. The question was what responsibility they had as de facto spokespeople for the area. Only the strong will survive, Petit declared. Then why are you encouraging everyone in the East to rebuild, said Contess, who made no effort to hide her irritation. She was single and self-employed. She sometimes struggled to make her bills. Even if she had wanted to start rebuilding, she didn't have the savings to float a six-figure repair bill while waiting on insurance companies and any help the state might provide through Road Home. If a community doesn't come back, Petit said, people will condense. They'll move to an area that's coming back. She sounded like Joe Cannizzaro, suggesting that people pour everything they had into returning, and if it didn't work out, our apology for having put you through all that trouble. It's dangerous to encourage people to move back someplace where there are no hospitals, Contess snapped. You don't encourage people to come back when there are no schools or adequate daycare. Pre-storm, Contess taught an average of 30 students at her seminars on intellectual property. Could she even draw a class of 10 if she moved back to New Orleans right now? I love my community like everyone else, but it's not fair what you're asking of people, Contess said. This is where we choose to live, Tangi said. This is where all of us choose to live. Seeking a safer subject, they talked of the good things going on in the East. Tangi told them about Rodney's Snowball opening on Lake Forest Boulevard and a Super Cajun, which at least meant decent takeout. And who's eating there? Cassandra asked. Driving around earlier that day, she had seen maybe three trailers in her subdivision of 75 homes. Contess had also been shocked by how little activity she saw when she visited her neighborhood on a Saturday. A few people repairing roofs, Contess said, a few trailers, but few people actually living. I'm living out there, Tangi interjected. There's a lot more activity than she's saying. Excuse me, I'm there two or three times a week, Contess said. I've lived there since 1988. I know what my neighbors are thinking. Contess brought up the displeasure she felt toward Tangi as one of those working to block the rebuilding of the apartment buildings along the interstate. That's discrimination, Contess charged. You can't say the homeowners deserve the right to return, but not the people in the apartments. I don't want to hear any more of this gloom and doom talk, Tangi exclaimed. The media and the politicians were bad enough, but her sisters had joined the naysayers. We need to give people hope, not tell them everything that might be wrong, Tangi said. The day before, she had been at the big New Orleans East neighborhood meeting organized by planners working with Lambert. They put forward a wonderful plan, Tangi told them, about the better class of retailer they would draw to the area and also the higher caliber restaurants, and that's not a fight I'm willing to run from. Several sisters chimed in at once, but Contess kept talking until the others were silent. She reminded them of her community involvement over the years and caused snickers when she claimed, not for the first time, that the idea for Eastern New Orleans united and whole was hers, not Tangi and Robbins. With Contess, it's always me, 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 Petit later said. I've always been very outspoken, Contess said. I've always been politically active, but I'm being practical. Normally, Tangi plays peacemaker, but she was one of the main combatants. Robin stepped into the breach. No one is saying the East is coming back tomorrow. No one is saying the East is coming back next year. But I think we can all agree the East will be back in 5 years. And I, for one, am going to do my part to see that it comes back as some place we'd all want to live. And what do you do during those 5 years? Contess asked. Robin, I live in my house. Petit, you live in your house and be happy you're home and you stop complaining. One of the sisters growled in a playful way to suggest a catfight, prompting a burst of giggles. Contess, however, was not in a laughing mood. Her voice louder, her tone stentorian, she said, you're still talking individuals. I'm talking community. I'm talking about looking at the greater good. Ray Nagin slipped back into his Katrina wear with the media in town in anticipation of the one-year anniversary. The mayor donned a red, short-sleeved polo for a tour of the Lower Ninth for 60 minutes. Nagin was probably aiming to play the role of the leader who has everything under control, but even he seemed shocked by the lack of progress there. The Lower Ninth in August 2006 looked as bad as it had when 60 Minutes was there in October 2005. Nagin started ray-raying about the bulldozers and property rights and the delays these fights were causing, but the reporter assigned the story, CBS's Brian Pitts, cut him off. Pitts pointed to the flood-damaged cars lining the road and a splintered home with only a small corner of its roof still intact. Objects that could have been cleared months earlier without a complaint. A defensive Nagin tried to appear nonchalant, but his words would echo for days on cable and elsewhere. That's all right. You guys in New York can't get a hole in the ground fixed, and it's 5 years later. New Orleans mayor takes a swipe at NYC, read a CBS press release that guaranteed Nagin's elegant words would overshadow talk of New Orleans 12 months after the storm. I meant no disrespect for anyone, Nagin explained on that week's Meet the Press, but he would refuse to apologize, earning the mayor a stern lecture from Tim Russert about what the country owed those who lost family members on that hallowed ground. Closer to home, Nagin pontificated on the future of some of New Orleans' neighborhoods in a sit-down with the Times-Picayune's Gordon Russell for a big anniversary piece they would be running in the Sunday paper. New Orleans East is showing some signs of recovery, but it's vast. It's going to hit the wall, Nagin said. There's just such a big footprint. I don't think they're going to get the clustering they need. So I think you're going to have little pockets in the East. He was more pessimistic about the lower ninth. I've been saying this publicly, and people are starting to hear it. Low-lying areas of New Orleans East and the lower ninth ward, stay away from. Nagin singled out the area north of Claiborne Avenue by the levee breach. We can't touch that. At a press conference that same week, he offered this advice to the citizens of New Orleans. You can't wait on government. You have to figure out a way to partner with your neighbors. Then, sounding more fortune cookie than mayor, he added, the road to recovery is long and arduous. Nagin was traveling a lot, too much according to some. There was even a rumor that the mayor had moved to Dallas, where his wife was still living a year after Katrina. No one could begrudge the mayor his flights to Washington, but he also made fundraising trips to Baton Rouge, Philadelphia, and New York, according to a website called wheresnagin.com. A local radio talk show host took to referring to the mayor as Ray Nagin. A new onion-like publication, the New Orleans Levee, ran a Ray Nagin version of Where's Waldo? Nagin, post-Katrina, was a man without allies and with few friends. The first 3 years of his tenure had been marked by breakfast meetings at Le Pavilion with the likes of Joe Cannizzaro and dinners with representatives of the business elite at Clancy's, where tuxedo-clad waiters served the uptown royals their shrimp remoulade and crawfish etouffee. Forget Ron Foreman, the so-called friend who ran against me, as Nagin put it on the campaign trail. The two saw one another around town, but Foreman described their encounters as civil but brief. He was always cool Ray. Hey man, how you doing? A high five, maybe a hug, Foreman said. There'd be no contact between Nagin and Jimmy Reese, and it was over with Nagin's former friends from the business council. It didn't need to end between the mayor and Bill Hines, who had helped run the mayor's 2002 transition team. The managing partner at the city's largest law firm, Hines, was an old-fashioned Rockefeller Republican who pushed a pro-business agenda but was otherwise liberal on most issues. He was a generous philanthropist who could be counted on to support any effort that had as its goal helping the less fortunate. Voluble and fun-loving, intent on eating each day the best New Orleans had to offer, Hines was in the business of getting along with everyone. He would see former mayor Mark Morial at a Hornets game, at least when the city had a professional basketball team. The Hornets would play their home games in Oklahoma City for two seasons after Katrina and give him a hug hello, scandalizing his uptown friends. Hines and his wife had gone out with Nagin and Salitha during the first term, but any semblance of a friendship ended after Hines threw his support to Mitch Landrieu. Despite Hines' efforts, he and Nagin were now just nodding acquaintances. I think Ray lumped me in with the rest of the white business community, and that was that, Hines said. David White had stuck by Nagin. Probably Ray Nagin's only real friend, Ron Foreman said. Yet White was also shy, and his relationship with the high-profile Nagin put him closer to the spotlight. Money was also a complicating factor. I didn't really get involved in city politics in Ray's second term, White said. The rest of Nagin's inner circle was also disintegrating. Greg Maffert resigned that summer. The two hadn't known one another before Nagin offered him a top job in his administration, but within several years, they were vacationing together with their wives and kids. They were in Hawaii in 2004 and Jamaica a couple of months after Katrina. We were daredevils, action junkies, whatever you want to call it. That's why we got closer than anybody else, Mefert said. Otherwise, there was very little I have in common with the dude. Mefert had never made it a secret that the $150,000 a year he was earning as a top mayoral aide was nothing compared to what he could command in the private sector. In a farewell press release, Nagin described Mefert as instrumental in our recovery and revitalization. Nagin hired a white woman named Donna Atkinson to retool his executive team after Mefert left. Atkinson had been the deputy chief of staff to a Mississippi governor. Nagin charged her with running about half the city bureaucracy. She would be gone after a year. About the only top person left from Nagin's pre-Katrina days was Brenda Hatfield, the old friend he had brought in to serve as his chief of staff after his first two picks washed out. I don't know if Ray ever recovered from the hurricane, said Ron Forman. He seemed a real lonely figure in his second term without anyone to really talk to. Ray Nagin claimed New Orleans had a population of roughly 250,000 at the one-year anniversary, a little over half of its pre-Katrina population. Entergy, however, claimed they were delivering power to only 80,000 customers that summer, including trailers, barely 40% of its pre-storm load. The post office estimated that New Orleans was a city of 171,000, 37% of its population before Katrina. Most every part of the city had electricity, gas, and sewer service. Drinkable water was available everywhere but the lower ninth and small pockets around the city. Yet not until November 2006 could Nagin announce that every part of New Orleans had working sewers, drinkable water, phones, and power. Even then, he couldn't make any promises. The water system was a sieve. Because of thousands of cracks in the lines, the city was pumping 130 million gallons to deliver 50 million gallons of drinking water to customers, the Times-Picayune's Michelle Krupa found, at a cost of $200,000 a day. But at least residents could count on water when they turned on the faucet. The city's gas and electric company, Entergy, was in bankruptcy and claiming $680 million in storm losses. The Bush administration had already rejected its request for a taxpayer bailout, and the utility was threatening a 25% rate increase without state aid from Baton Rouge. 21 months after Katrina, Louisiana would give the company $172 million in aid through its Community Development Block Grant Program. Meanwhile, blackouts were frequent in a jury-rigged power system sensitive to overloads and even the weather. The city had made progress. A baler had crushed 300,000 ruined refrigerators into 1-ton rectangular-shaped cubes and sold them for scrap. The Corps and its contractors had begun to remove the tens of thousands of abandoned cars littering the city's streets. Yet even as the Corps did its job, the trash continued to pile up as more people cleaned out their homes. The Corps shipped in giant shredders for the ruined sheetrock, soaked furniture, and the other detritus the city was kicking to the curb. That helped reduce the volume, but the garbage still needed to end up somewhere. In February, with the city's landfills filling up, Nagin issued a temporary 6-month permit allowing for a dump site along the border of the Bayou Sauvage National Wildlife Refuge on the eastern edge of New Orleans East. That led to another battle. The proposed dump was down the road from the village Del East, whose residents blockaded the road until Nagin agreed he wouldn't extend the temporary permit. That left the city scrambling to find alternatives. People around the city were getting sick from mold. The Katrina cough, locals called it, a dry, persistent hack brought on by mold spores and other irritants in the air. To John Bijunet, a local playwright who had more than 4 feet of water in his home, people who had endured a year of Katrina couldn't fully enjoy a movie or a favorite TV show. People lost their ability to let go and allow themselves to fully inhabit another character, Bijunet said. On Sundays, Bijunet and his neighbors would gather at what some called the pretend cafe. They'd brew their coffee at home, take a folding chair and the paper, and head for Fair Grinds Coffee House, though the popular mid-city cafe was still closed. During these weekly gripe sessions, Bijunet usually carped about his insurance company and the frustrations of starting over again with a new claims adjuster. He remembered 6 or 7 adjusters, but his wife swears they went through 9 in 12 months. "We were like traumatized war victims," Bijunet said. "You don't realize how strange things are when you're in the middle of it." 4 of the city's 7 general hospitals were still closed, including Charity. A survey taken several months before the anniversary found that 77% of the city's primary care physicians were still not back. 89% of its psychiatrists were still missing. There is no hospital at all in the city for psychiatric patients, Loyola law professor Bill Quigley wrote on Counterpunch at the one-year anniversary. The metro area had 450 psych beds before the storm. It now had 80. In June, the federal government had announced its intention to demolish the city's 4 largest housing projects, the Big Four, as they were known. That represented nearly 5,000 apartments and well over half the city's public housing units. Under the HUD plan, private developers would build mixed-income complexes in place of all 4. In its rush to demolish the apartment complexes and replace them with the kind of generic mixed-income suburban community so favored by Washington bureaucrats, the agency demonstrates great insensitivity to both the displaced tenants and the urban fabric of the city, wrote New York Times architecture critic Nikolai Urosov. Residents and their supporters established a tent city outside the city's largest housing projects and shouted down the federal housing officials who arrived to explain their plan. Protesters broke into one of the Big Four to help a man move back into his old apartment, and then, after he was booted by an armed SWAT team, several residents broke into another. Lawsuits were filed on behalf of residents in a small demonstration held outside Nagin's home. Among those speaking out against the demolition plan was Tulane's Lance Hill, who told the New York Times' Susan Salney, "The people who've been planning the recovery process never wanted poor people to return to the city in the first place." But Hill and the protesters would find few allies among elected officials, black or white. They were noticeably silent on the issue. "The city has nothing to do with this," Nagin said. Only around 1,000 of the housing authority's units had been reopened since Katrina. The great experiment, as some would eventually call the transformation of the city's public schools, was another issue dividing the city. Where before Katrina the city was home to only a few charter schools, soon New Orleans would become the first school district in the country with a majority of its students enrolled in a charter school. 2 dozen charters opened in anticipation of the new school year. No one knew what to expect in this overwhelmingly poor school district. Prior to the storm, 3 in every 4 public school students qualified for a subsidized lunch. by Katrina, only 4% of the kids attending the public schools were white. For some, anything would be an improvement over what they had pre-Katrina. The dropout rate at some high schools had been as high as 70%, and the city's math and reading proficiency scores were consistently among the worst in the state. A dysfunctional catastrophe, one unhappy white parent said of the pre-storm schools, under the control of a corrupt district office. He was inclined to celebrate more power in the hands of parents where he thought it belonged, but others stressed that a duly elected school board, a majority black body, had been stripped of its authority. Others, displeased with the state's custodianship, pointed to bad experiences in other places where the charters accepted only children willing to obey their rules or rejected those with learning disabilities and other students who might drag down test scores. The parents of those kids would need to fend for themselves. Broken stoplights still dangled in parts of the central business district. Stores even in the center of town remained shuttered a year after Katrina. To reach the city's economic development office, one entered through a side door as the revolving doors out front were still boarded up. Shell was back, but Chevron announced it was moving its offices to higher ground in the suburbs. Traffic at the port was almost back to normal, but the city's manufacturing base post-Katrina was almost non-existent. One survey found that 12 months after the storm, 2 in every 3 businesses were still closed. Shops catering to tourists complained that they were doing maybe half their pre-storm business. One local economist predicted that 40% of the city's businesses would end up a casualty of Katrina. The few big box retailers knew they could do a brisk business even in sparsely populated parts of town, basically Home Depot and Lowe's, but the big national and regional chains were slow to reopen. At first, that surprised Richard Campanella, a geographer at Tulane, who has written extensively about New Orleans and its history, but it came to make sense. The small mom and pops had everything invested in one store. They have no choice but to do whatever they can to come back, Campanella said. After September 11, the state and federal governments had set aside $500 million to help small businesses in New York. That figure would be $38 million for small businesses in Louisiana hit by either Katrina or Rita. Sitting in Memphis, Anthony Patton was still technically president of Ebony Networks, running a 10-person firm he touted as the South's premier African-American marketing company. He had earned a spot on the Bring New Orleans Back Commission. Yet 1 year after Katrina, he had no clients and no employees. All the African-American businesses are gone, Patton said. The optimists thought about the billions in government money that would soon be washing through New Orleans. They imagined an arts-infused mecca for youthful risk-takers, a boomtown where entrepreneurs can repair to cool French Quarter bars in ancient buildings after a hard day of deal-making, wrote the Times' Adam Nossiter, who lived in New Orleans at the time. The pessimists were worried that New Orleans was on its way to becoming the country's next Detroit, a city of abandoned neighborhoods. Others fretted that the new New Orleans would become a hollowed-out, Disney-fied version of itself. The city's aristocracy would still put on carnival each year, and the city's main attractions would remain its food and music. But in this vision, about all that would be left of New Orleans would be the tourists and the people getting rich off them, along with the low-paid housekeepers, waiters, busboys, and bartenders to keep everything going. Houston was home to more evacuees than anywhere else. that for spring after Katrina, the city polled those who had availed themselves of a free housing program set up to get people out of the Astrodome and other shelters. 9 months after Katrina, only 1 in 7 of them had a job. Most were either people over 55 or single mothers. Over 90% of the people here are either suicidal or hopeless, a dispossessed 34-year-old named Alfonso Thomas said of his fellow evacuees. Time has long since passed for the able-bodied people from Louisiana to either find a job, return to somewhere in Louisiana, or become Houstonians, a Houston congressman named John Culberson, a Republican, said of the deadbeat New Orleanians who had invaded his city. Those stranded in Houston were blamed for an increase in crime, a claim later refuted by studies. Where once displaced New Orleanians were slapping a "Thanks Houston" bumper sticker on a car, many now felt as though they had worn out their welcome. Negin first imagined fireworks. He suggested a comedy night as well for the evening of August 29th. Ultimately, the city chose a more solemn set of events to commemorate the one-year anniversary of Katrina. At a prayer breakfast that morning, Negin rang a large silver bell at 9:38 a.m., which is believed to be the time of the catastrophic 7th Street breach. Later that morning, Negin joined the president, who was in town and speaking at a new charter school. Bush declared August 29, 2006, a National Day of Remembrance and reiterated the pledge he had made at his Jackson Square speech to do whatever it took to rebuild New Orleans. His motorcade then crossed the bridge in the Lower Ninth Ward, where the president visited the home of R&B legend Fats Domino, who had been airlifted from there several days after Katrina. No one knew exactly how many people died in Katrina. They never would, after the state of Louisiana in 2006 defunded the project it had set up to identify unidentified bodies and calculate how many bodies might have washed out to sea. Some bodies were still buried in plain sight, such as the body that had been discovered in the rubble just before the anniversary. 1 year after Katrina, the best the authorities could do was to declare that at least 1,800 people across the Gulf Coast had died in the storm. More than 1,100 of them were from New Orleans. Katrina offered plenty of ammunition to Democrats seeking to discredit a sitting president with Republican majorities in both the House and the Senate. We know the storm was a tragedy, but a bigger tragedy is how the federal government responded, Harry Reid, then the Senate Minority Leader, declared in August, a little more than 2 months before the 2006 midterm elections. That summer, it seemed half the Bush cabinet was on the Gulf Coast to announce new initiatives. I take full responsibility for the federal government's response, Bush declared around the first anniversary. Yet it was too late for a president saddled by both Katrina and Iraq. Democrats gained 31 seats in the House that November, enough to make Nancy Pelosi the body's first female speaker. Harry Reid would take over as majority leader after the Democrats picked up 6 seats in the Senate. The city of Gretna returned to the news that summer. The state attorney general, Charles Foti Jr., completed his investigation into the blockade. Foti was a local, a white man who had recently been elected attorney general after 30 years as the Orleans Parish criminal sheriff. Rather than take a stance, Foti had his people deliver a report on the case to a long list of law enforcement officials, including the FBI, the local U.S. attorney, and U.S. Attorney General Albert Gonzalez. Others were free to venture into the racial politics of Gretna should they choose. In August, Orleans Parish District Attorney Eddie Jordan, who was black, announced he had formed a grand jury to investigate the incident at Gretna. Another 5 civil suits were filed against the city, including a class action suit prepared on behalf of the RTA workers. "We saved our city," said Gretna Police Chief Arthur Lawson. "We put officers on the streets. We didn't allow joyriders or people to come into the city who didn't reside in the city. We set up perimeters. Our plan worked." Now, the judicial branch would decide whether, in protecting Gretna's streets, rights had been trampled. That summer, Lakeview Civic held a rebuilding workshop in the gym at St. Dom's. Connie Udo stood to talk about Beacon of Hope. Afterward, a priest named Will Hood introduced himself and asked her to take a walk with him. He was new to Lakeview, Hood confessed, a Navy chaplain recently returned from duty in Iraq. He had been hired as the rector of St. Paul, an Episcopal church in Lakeview, with the understanding that he would probably shut down the church and its school. The parishioners he met, however, didn't seem ready to give up. Each more or less greeted him the same way. "Thank God you're here. What can we do to help?" He convinced the bishop to let him try to save St. Paul. He told Udo, and had even secured funding from the diocese to help him rebuild the neighborhood. Hood and Udo were a few blocks from the church when the priest pointed to an empty building. He'd already spoken to the landlord, he said. The place would be ready and available within 4 weeks. He wanted to use the space to create a recovery command center. "But I can't do it and rebuild a church and school," he said. Did Udo want the job? Udo first asked whether it made a difference that she was Catholic. Her second question was why her. Hood told her he had driven through her neighborhood and been impressed. "I can tell you're combat ready," he told her. 1 month later, on the August 29th anniversary date, Udo opened the doors to St. Paul's Homecoming Center. Udo figured she'd be there a year, maybe two, and then go back to teaching tennis. Chapter 20. Road Home. Professional football returned to New Orleans in the fall of 2006. The city had been excited about a team that ended the 2004 season with 4 consecutive wins, but after the storm hit, fans suffered through a dismal year. The Saints lost 13 of their 16 games playing home games in Baton Rouge, San Antonio, and even New Jersey, where the end zones of the Meadowlands were spray-painted the Saints' colors and the hometown Giants wore their road uniforms. The league did what it could to give the state, which owns the Superdome, the time needed to ready the stadium. The Saints played their preseason home games in Shreveport and Jackson, Mississippi, and their first 2 regular season games were on the road. Under a new coach, Sean Payton, and led by a new quarterback, Drew Brees, the Saints won the first 2 games of the season, raising expectations for the first professional football game to be played in New Orleans in 22 months. The Superdome, a vast upside-down dish that seats 70,000, was sold out. U2 and Green Day played a mini 3-song set before the game began, and former President George H.W. Bush was there for the coin toss. 4 plays into the game, a Saints reserve named Steve Gleason blocked a punt, and a backup cornerback named Curtis DeLoach recovered the ball in the end zone for a touchdown. "It was like an explosion," DeLoach said. "It was like I just gave New Orleans a brand new city." The Saints beat their division rival, the Atlanta Falcons, 23-3 in a stadium coach Sean Payton declared the loudest he had ever heard. That year, the team notched only its 2nd playoff win in franchise history and would miss out on its first Super Bowl appearance after losing to Chicago in the NFC Championship game. Martin Landrieu and his team had submitted their plan for Lakeview to the city. So too did Charmaine Marchand in the Lower Ninth and others around the city. New Orleans, however, was still a long way from submitting a written plan to the Louisiana Recovery Authority to free up the billions in recovery dollars that New Orleans was due. The city still hadn't heard from those who hadn't managed to make it home yet, and Carrie Shea, the Rockefeller Foundation's point person in New Orleans, was determined that they have their say before a plan was submitted. Shea, from New York, moved to New Orleans over the July 4th weekend, 2006. Talking to people involved in the planning that summer, she concluded that Nagin had made a key tactical mistake when he gave the job of rebuilding to the Bring New Orleans Back Commission. Ordinary New Orleanians needed to feel as though they had been included in the decision-making. Instead, they were asked to wait patiently while a group of CEOs and other elites determined their fate. Shea also came to believe the city had brought in the Urban Land Institute prematurely. At that point, the city needed group therapy, not a bunch of outsiders telling them they needed to give up on their homes. What the plan was missing was community buy-in, Shea said. So I went to the other foundations that had been watching a little bit from a distance and shared my concern that voices weren't being heard from what everyone was calling then the diaspora. A foundation created by George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton, the Bush-Clinton-Katrina Fund, chipped in $1 million. The Annie E. Casey Foundation, the state of Louisiana, and other organizations contributed millions more. They would need all that money and more for what Shea had in mind. A woman she knew had attended a September 11 related event at the Javits Center in New York that had been organized by a group called America Speaks. Shea's friend had been impressed by the diversity of the crowd that had arrived at the Javits Center that day and wowed by the technical capabilities of a group that issued every participant an electronic pad for instant voting. They're like a production company in the business of putting on these ginormous meetings, Shea said of America Speaks. It's very therapeutic. The person running the thing cries. There's praying, there's music, but maybe most important, they're really good at creating consensus around broad issues. Shea hired America Speaks for what they were calling a community congress, the big event held in New Orleans in October 2006 to give ordinary citizens a chance to talk about the city's future. Shea was impressed as she watched America Speaks prepare in the months before the community congress. Their people put together a list of FEMA trailer camps in southern Louisiana and sent people to visit each one. They arranged for vans and buses to shuttle those needing transportation. They also contacted people in Houston, Atlanta, and other cities to spread the word. But the community congress would prove a disappointment. They had expected 1,000 people, but only 350 showed, and half of them were staff. Three-quarters of those in attendance were white, and nearly half had an annual household income above $75,000. Hardly the dispossessed population organizers were hoping to hear from. Just their luck, NPR reporter Martin Kaste was in town for a piece on the city with no plan and captured the disappointment. "We're like lemmings going off a cliff," one participant told Kaste for a report that aired on NPR a week later. Violence was still a constant in a city that had enough problems without people killing one another. An Iraq war veteran living in the French Quarter killed and mutilated his girlfriend and then threw himself off a nearby hotel roof. On Halloween, a gunman walked into a Quarter nightclub and shot 5 people. Drug-related murders were on the rise and domestic violence spiked, driving up the number of women living on the street. People don't realize this isn't a normal community yet, New Orleans Police Chief Warren Riley told USA Today. Was it any wonder that a University of New Orleans political scientist found that 32% of returnees were considering leaving? Chief Riley and his top people were still working out of trailers. New Orleans still had no working crime lab. FEMA had filed the requisite damage assessment reports for the city's police headquarters and its damaged precinct houses, but that was only the start of a long, drawn-out process. When the money might be pried from the federal treasury so work could begin on essential government buildings was one of many unknowns inside City Hall. A beleaguered police department was also contending with scandal. 6 days after Katrina, the police responding to a call for help on the Danziger Bridge, a small stretch of high ground between Gentilly and New Orleans East, killed two people and shot four others, though civilian witnesses claimed all of the victims were unarmed. So too did other officers. One victim was a mentally disabled man shot in the back while trying to run. Seven officers were indicted on charges ranging from obstruction of justice to murder. The year 2006 ended grimly with the murder of a drummer from the popular Hot 8 brass band. The shooter killed the wrong person. The new year wasn't a week old, and already the city had recorded 8 murders. In a city where the typical murder victim was a young black man living in a high crime area, the body count included a young uptown woman found shot dead in her bed and a prominent local filmmaker killed during a home invasion in the Margeny district. Her husband, a doctor, was also shot, while their 2-year-old son survived. Killings bring the city to its bloodied knees, cried the Times-Picayune on its front page the next day. A crowd of around 5,000 showed up at City Hall for an anti-crime rally and hurled angry words at both the mayor and Chief Riley. The killings, however, continued. Pre-Katrina, the police would record around 1,000 violent crimes each quarter. Fewer than half the city's population had returned, but there would be more than 1,300 violent crimes reported in the first 3 months of 2007. Surge in homeless hits New Orleans, read a Christian Science Monitor headline that March. Whereas the city had around 6,000 homeless people before Katrina, now an estimated 12,000 people were sleeping in cars, abandoned motels, or under highway overpasses. Most of the city's emergency shelters were still closed, while meanwhile a new population was demanding the attention of people such as Martha Kegel, the Stanford law grad who ran a local advocacy group for the homeless. People in their late 80s, Kegel said, who never in their lives expected to be homeless. The housing policies adopted by some of New Orleans' suburban neighbors didn't help a city in dire need of more affordable units. St. Bernard Parish, the white flight suburb just south and east of New Orleans, passed what its sponsor called a blood relative ordinance. In a parish where whites owned 93% of the housing stock, the new law dictated that landlords could rent only to family members. The parish would pass another law barring the redevelopment of any property with more than 4 units. The main target of this second ordinance seemed to be the Village Square, a sprawling 100-building complex occupied mainly by low-income African-American renters. Officials in Jefferson Parish blocked construction of a 200-unit residential facility for the elderly, and at least one city there placed a moratorium on multi-family units. Insurance companies were a constant topic of conversation in wounded New Orleans. Those who had splurged on a comprehensive homeowners policy learned that comprehensive didn't include floods. Homeowners insurance generally covered wind damage, but even a hole in the roof through which rain had fallen might not be enough proof that a house had been damaged by more than floodwaters. People believed that the insurance companies offered a fraction of what they owed and then waited to see who had the will to fight for more. The Louisiana Department of Insurance was receiving 20,000 calls a month. Nearly 5,000 people had leveled a formal complaint in 2006. 6,600 insurance-related lawsuits had been filed in federal district court in New Orleans by the first half of 2007. Alden McDonald had no argument over his personal insurance coverage. He had received the maximum $250,000 from his flood insurance carrier, plus another $75,000 or so to cover his home's contents, but he had no roof damage and didn't expect any more money under his homeowner's policy. But his brother, Byron, needed to sue his carrier before he received anything near what he felt was a fair settlement. Flood insurance had paid the full $250,000 on the two-story, $350,000 brick home Byron owned in Gentilly, but the Hanover Insurance Group offered him close to nothing under a $200,000 homeowner's policy, despite the hole in his roof after the wind tore off a ventilator. Hanover claimed Byron owed them money, given the $1,500 check they mistakenly believed they sent to Byron and his wife to cover their temporary living expenses. A month before they were scheduled to go to trial, Hanover settled for an amount Byron cannot reveal, given a binding non-disclosure agreement. Insurance industry spokespeople pointed out that carriers had collectively paid out a record $11 billion to homeowners in Louisiana after Katrina. But the $49 billion in profits insurance firms pocketed that year was also an all-time insurance industry high. The state officials behind the Road Home program were among those convinced insurers were shortchanging people. By their calculations, homeowners were paid on average $5,700 less than they were owed. No small matter for a program created to make up the difference between what a property was worth and the actual insurance payment a homeowner received. State officials figured that would add another $900 million to the cost of making people whole under Road Home.
Context of white supremacy. For the people that are listening to the archive, all of this will sound very strange because there won't be any noticeable problem for the folks listening that way. But for the live listeners, we had massive issues. I can't really say it's unusual because it's not the first time that it happened. But everything crashed during the close to the end of the first audio segment. I think everybody got disconnected from the free HD line. I know I did. But that was not even the first problem. The initial problem was the audio stopped closer to the end of the first audio segment. I thought it was just going to be a brief glitch, and then everything connected with the free HD line failed. The switchboard, my phone line, the audio, everything. I called them to see if I could get some assistance in solving the problem. They were very little help. The best that they said was that they didn't think the problem would be solved this evening. That hopefully they could have it corrected by tomorrow. If that is the case, then you know I'll make sure that I have the information for the different number that we'll be using for the compensatory call-in if the problem is not corrected in 24 hours. But to be expected, that is racism, white supremacy. We have been on the air and actually had white people cancel our program while we were in the middle of the broadcast. That has happened before, in addition to all the other problems and what have you. You just chalk all of that up, probably racist interference. At any rate, we continue. Ninth study session, Gary Rivlin, Katrina after the flood, for folks who would like to participate. If you are listening online, if you want to dial in, you'll have to use a new number. Hopefully it'll be temporary and you won't have to go through too many changes. But the new number, if you want to participate, is 712 770-4010. And the code is 425022#. So the new number, at least for this evening, temporary, hopefully, is 712-770-4010. The code is 425022#. If you enter that, should connect you. I'll see you on the screen. Should be actually, I guess it's not the same procedure. I think for this one, I have not used this before, so I don't know all the ins and outs. The switchboard, I'm learning on the fly. But for this one, I think when you dial in, your line will be muted. Your line will be open. And so if you want to chime in, your line should be open. If you just call to listen on the phone line, then I can mute your line manually. But I will give out the number a few more times as we proceed. I'm sure some folks we will miss in all of the confusion and what have you, because it took a little while to kind of get things sorted out and figure the best way to proceed. But nonetheless, do our best to make do of an unpleasant situation. I was able to take notes, so the disruption didn't impact too much in terms of my note taking. Plus, I had already read this before, so I was ready to roll anyway. If there are folks that are listening in, if you have comments that you would like to share on the book, feel free. Everyone that dialed in on the temporary line for the evening, line should be open. If you have comments you want to share on the book, please proceed. Right on. Some folks that are dialed in, if you all are just listening, that is fine as well. Check one more time. If anyone that dialed in on the line, that you have any comments to share on the book, or folks just listening in.
Hi, can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I'm unmuted now. Okay. Yeah, I had just dialed in, and then you said Nancy Pelosi, and I thought you were going to say the first female Speaker of the House, but, man, it went blank, and I just didn't know what to do, and I happen to be on Facebook here, and thank you for putting that post up. I'm calling from the 712, so that's interesting that you got a 712 phone number. Wow. All right, well, okay, I just want you to know I'm here, I'm listening.
Appreciate it. Thank you for hanging in there, doing as we can. Hopefully it will be resolved tomorrow. That is the system of white supremacy. Expect anything, particularly anything that's non-constructive. I mean, that shouldn't be surprising at all. I will go ahead and share some of the things that I noted, and then if folks have any other comments, we can make do with that. My timing is thrown off. I normally have a better gauge of the timing between the first segment and the second segment, but this disrupted a whole lot of things. I will try to backtrack here. We were started in 19, kind of the early portion of 19, looking at some of the planning that they were supposed to be doing. This is 2006 going into 2007. I think for most of the things that were discussed this week, when he started off with this big conversation with the Wall family, Tanji and Cassandra and Robin and Petit and everyone, I'm sure I'm probably missing somebody. I'm curious, Mr. Rivlin should be on the program next month. I'm curious if he was like present for this conversation, because I know he met with some of the different people in the book like repeatedly throughout the years that he was covering Katrina in New Orleans, and then the work that he did to actually write the book. But I would like to know if like he was there, like when they were sitting down to have this little conversation between them, is he there? Did they have a recorder? and just do it for him that way, or, you know, just how did he get privy to, like, the exact, how did he get privy to the exact information because all this stuff is in quotes, right? This is not like him talking like somebody who's given a paraphrase or a summary of what was being discussed. All of this is as though he was there or somebody was there and they got an exact transcript of what they said. That's one I would like to get clarification on when he comes to visit us down the road. The Village Del East, there's a whole documentary on that. These Vietnamese non-white people in New Orleans East, where they had this temporary assignment of the dump site. There's a whole documentary on that. I think it just came out, unless they re-broadcast it, but it came on PBS right in the middle of everything around the 10-year anniversary when they made note of that and the protest that they made about keeping the dump site out of their region. It was these non-white, quote-unquote, Vietnamese people, as well as just regular black people in New Orleans East, who were saying, we do not want this stuff here. And I mean, it's a lot more detail. It's probably 1,000 different things within the context of this story that you could just stop and just focus on that and do a whole book or series or project. I think I said that about the St. Augustine Church that came up in the broadcast last week. I said the same thing about that. This dump site is another one where there's a lot of information around what happened with this and the protest and kind of going back and forth and wrangling about this and the scientific ramifications of putting this stuff in the ground in this area, long-term effects, and just another means of contaminating, poisoning non-white people. I think I've said consistently on the program that that's one thing that I really feel like I personally should have done more over the years that we've been doing the broadcast, just to focus on how this is strategic. This is done consistently and around the world, where white people will come and dump all kinds of toxins and poisons, either in the water supply or in the ground or wherever they happen to put it at. Lead poisoning, they were talking about that in Philadelphia and Baltimore and different areas. And then when you end up with all of these health problems, the black people end up with all of these health conditions, then it's, oh, man, I don't know how that happened. Wow, that's so surprising. And birth defects and so on and so forth. I have compared consistently what happened with some of the white people in Lakeview and other areas who had lots of money, lots of resources, where some of them had moved back into their residences by February. That's only like 4 or 5 months after the storm. Others had moved back in 8 months. They had moved back into their storm, where you're hearing from some of the Wall sisters where a year has passed and they maybe got 40% of their house back together, 80% of their house back together, maybe none of it back together, still trying to figure out. And exactly what I said last week when they said in Lakeview, where they had electricity back and had their little armed band of folks that were coming through to clean the streets and get up debris and get things looking spiffy again over in Lakeview, where the white people were. Exactly what I said last week. There are black people who didn't even have running water in different parts, poor parts of New Orleans. No surprise there either. Moving forward, some of the other things that I thought were important, and I'll make sure to get the name of that documentary film if folks want to check that out on the dump site, because I thought that was pretty interesting too. When they were talking about Ray Nagin being alone and isolated, that to me did not sound surprising at all, particularly given all of the white people who were responsible for him being in City Hall in the mayor's office to begin with, that all of them totally rejected him. We're done. You're ignorant. You're stupid. You can't run the city. I think last week they called him a racist, too. I can totally understand him getting to a point where he does not trust people and doesn't want to talk to folks and feeling like people are out to get him, because that's what it is. I can totally relate to that. And I think white people are very good about putting black people in these positions where you feel isolated and feel like everybody's coming after you, or you don't really know who to trust, or feel like people have abandoned you. People like Ron Forman, Sally Forman, she used to be a part of his mayoral cabinet, ends up running against him. This is somebody he thought was his friend and supporting him. Now he's saying, oh, my God, this is the worst guy for the job. He's incompetent, worst mayor ever, can't do it. We got to get somebody else in there, a white person in there. Some of the other things that stood out, lack of drinkable water, I touched on that as well. When they talked about the frequent blackouts because of their jury-rigged power system, Number one, they keep saying about how Entergy could not get a bailout. That's something that should, I'm sure that will probably come up later in the program, in the book rather, about Entergy not getting a bailout, but then them doing that for some of these banks and other industries down the road, just a few short years later. I'm sure that'll come up later in the book. With the blackout, I don't know if it's going to come up later or not, but I just keep thinking about the Super Bowl with the Ravens and the 49ers. I think that was in the Superdome where the power went out and disrupted the game. I don't know if that's connected to this at all or if that'll come up in the book, but that did keep popping in my mind. Let's see. What else stood out? 77% of the city's primary care physicians were still not back, and this is a year or more after the storm. Again, that's the type of thing that I think would really disproportionately impact black people who would have a more difficult time getting access to health care anyway. And then now it's, man, it's almost no doctors in the city. And that would just be another reason. I even heard that from some of the black evacuees, that that was a deciding factor in them not coming back to New Orleans because there were no services. And I think some of the Wall sisters made that point, that it can be dangerous to come back, particularly if you have special needs or if you're elderly and you're going to need medical care or whatever, even if you're not elderly, just needing access to quality health care and you don't have it. That can be a huge deterrent. And it was for some people who just said, forget it. I'm going to stay in Houston or Atlanta or wherever they happen to end up at. Let's see. About the housing situation, I knew that was going to come full force, and we still haven't even got all that. When they go about not opening back up housing, public housing projects for black residents, the portion where the protesters broke into one of the big four housing projects to help a man move back into his old apartment. And then after he was booted by an armed SWAT team, several residents broke into another. I think they eventually escalated it to putting lead sheets over the windows and barbed wire fencing around all of the units to make sure that there was no way or to greatly minimize the opportunity and means for black people to try to come back in and reoccupy some of these units. And even some white people in New Orleans emphasized that this was people in housing units that were not damaged by the flood, where people, black people predominantly, left in a hurry, right, to evacuate or try to get to a safe point. Left and were never allowed to return. That happened with some people. They were never allowed back into their residence, never got to go in to get belongings, clean up, nothing. Like, left to save their life and lost everything, not to the flood, but just because they decided that they were going to shut down public housing. The dropout rate being 70% in some of the high schools prior to Katrina, long legacy. I said we were going to talk about this. Is going to continue the discussion from what we had yesterday about the long legacy of black people not getting access to quality education. And about the, thought it was a great quote, which said one of the parents who was talking about the dysfunctional state of New Orleans public education, where Rivlin said that this parent was inclined, white parent was inclined to celebrate more power in the hands of parents where he thought it belonged. But others stressed that a duly elected school board, a majority black body, had been stripped of its authority. And I think even our guest yesterday, Dr. Travis Bristol, he and some of his colleagues looked at that, this major displacement of black educators in New Orleans and how that also impacted the economy of black people. A lot of folks lost their salaries and everything else when they were summarily fired after the storm. Let's see, anything else? The African-American businesses, the portion, this is Anthony Patton was technically still president of Ebony Networks, running a 10-person firm touted as the South's premier African-American marketing company. He had earned a spot on the Bring New Orleans Back Commission, yet 1 year after Katrina, he had no clients and no employees. All the African-American businesses are gone, Patton said. I thought that was huge. And again, just I keep saying with Mr. McDonald, Alden McDonald, the banker, even though it seems like he has a few more coins than maybe some of the other black people, it still seems like they are just having a really tough time in comparison to the other white people in terms of resources to get things moving again. And seeming like even for black entrepreneurs in New Orleans, that, man, this just wiped out a lot of people, that they did not have the resources, the means, and didn't get help afterwards to get their business back and rolling in the city of New Orleans. even the little casual comment that they made about Detroit becoming, or excuse me, New Orleans becoming like Detroit, a city of abandoned neighborhoods. Detroit, the reason that it looks the way it is, and we did this before on the program, Detroit looks that way because of racist man, racist woman, racist child. Beryl Satter, her book where it talks about all of the rampant fraud that white people engaged in the 60s and 70s when white people, or excuse me, when black people were trying to get access to property, and they deliberately went out and did all of this fraudulent activity in setting up these loans and what have you that just totally gutted black people and took all their money, and they ended up not getting houses, just figured out all of these tricky schemes to trick them out of their money and take the property back. That's why Detroit looks the way it is. That's why you have all these abandoned buildings. It's eloquently laid out. Beryl Satter, we had her on the program, I think, in May this year, where she talks about that. And that's something that never gets mentioned. They just like to talk about Detroit and say, oh, the black people looted and rioted and blame it on Kwame Kilpatrick and not just go into the details of what white people did to make Detroit what it is right now. Let's see. I thought also it was really important as well when they were talking about in Houston where they were going on the same thing that, oh, my God, these black New Orleans came here and ruined everything and they don't have jobs and these deadbeat no good Knicks need to get their act together and get a job or go back to Louisiana. I would say that most of the people were over 55 or single moms in terms of the population that came. These not exactly, I was talking about young people who just don't want to work. I would think most people that are single moms probably want to get a job, probably want to be able to take care of themselves and their family. That's what I've seen consistently in my life. And older people, it sounds like these folks would be getting ready for retirement. I mean, maybe they have a few more years of working in them. But I mean, if you're over 55, you should be closing in on settling down, getting a rocking chair and, you know, being an elder, somebody that we respect. And that's just not the way that they're talked about at all. And I appreciate him included. I don't know if he has it in the footnotes or not about the studies that refuted the claim that crime spiked in Houston because of this influx of black people from Louisiana. I don't know if that's in the footnotes or not. If it is, I will share so that people can check it out on their own. And also a point that I hammered a lot this summer in talking about the death toll, that all of the numbers that you see are false, that they have greatly minimized the amount of black death that took place in all of this, where they acknowledge that nobody would ever know the total number of people that died because the state of Louisiana in 2006 defunded the project. It had set up to identify unidentified bodies and calculate how many bodies might have washed out to sea. When you want to talk about total disregard for black life, and that is a consistent pattern when you have these sort of massacres and huge tragedies where a large number of black people die at one time, where it's just, whatever, if we count them, whatever, one dead nigger, 20 dead niggers, who cares? You know, let's just keep this moving. Let's see. The footnotes. The Danziger Bridge was brought up. That's something we've talked about before. I wrote the book review of Ronnie Green's book, Shots on the Bridge, which gives obviously a lot more detail about what happened with the Danziger Bridge incident. Just looking at the footnotes really quick to make sure I didn't miss anything there. He did include one note on the renters. I said that was going to come up later in the book. 18 months after Katrina, Road Home announced a program to replenish the area's rental stock by helping small landlords, those owning 5 units or fewer, repair flooded units. But property owners first needed to make repairs that could reach into the hundreds of thousands of dollars and rent out a unit before they could be reimbursed. The goal was the restoration of 18,000 units, not the 4,000 the state actually financed. That was one of the footnotes that they included. And let's see. Okay, that's just about the basketball team. Okay, I think that's most of the major notes that I had. I'll double check before we hit the second audio clip. Anybody else have anything they wanted to get in before we get to the second audio? The folks that dialed in should be with us. Anything they want to, you all want to make sure you get in? I assume folks are good. Didn't hear anything. The folks that dialed in line should be open. I assume nobody. No comments. Everybody satisfied.
Yeah, I want to say something. I mean, I didn't hear the first clip, like I said, when I came in, but it's disgusting, you know? And it's racism, white supremacy, and that's disgusting. And those teachers, you know, where did they go, you know? And it's a lot, so... I mean, I knew somebody that was there. They were in a place called Slidell, and she said it didn't. I guess it didn't go over there, but yeah.
Right on. Anybody else? Anybody else? Comments they want to make sure they get in. I know. I assume folks are satisfied. We will get to the second audio clip. If you have anything you would like to share, make note. You can share after the second audio clip concludes. Hopefully we will not have any interruptions during this segment. We are still, this is kind of towards the end of chapter 19, kind of towards the end. Oh, wait a minute. Make sure I didn't miss anything else. Oh, we're actually in the early portion of 20. Sorry. We moved into chapter 20, early portion of chapter 20. Oh, and they did include, I'll make sure I get that in as well. That's what I keep saying about Jefferson Parish. I'll get the footnote that's included with that, but I definitely appreciated them including that in white people in Jefferson Parish, that they moved to block the construction of a 200-unit residential facility for the elderly because they didn't want black people living in their area. He does have a footnote that's very important on that. That's something I've been bringing up the whole time because the folks in, I just forget the parish name not being there, but the people, the white people in that area, they purposely did not want black people in that area. This was a deliberate effort to block black residents, and it was a lot of this that went on after the storm, but I will be sure to touch on that. St. Bernard's Parish, super glad that they included that, but I'll get the footnote on the other side of the audio clip. Second audio clip, we're in the early stages of chapter 20, Mr. Gary Rivlin, Katrina after the flood. Ward Mac McClendon felt numb that first year after Katrina. Asleep, he said, even with his eyes open, hoping I'd wake up from a bad dream, except it only kept getting worse. McClendon had planned on riding out the storm at his daughter's home in Atlanta, but the traffic was so bad he stayed that Sunday night at a no-name motel in Opelika, Alabama. His daughter was about to give birth to her first child, but he heard about the levee breaches and returned to New Orleans rather than continue on to Atlanta, less than 2 hours away. I'm telling you, I wasn't in my right mind then, McClendon said. Back in New Orleans, he paid way too much to hole up in a flea bag motel while waiting the 2 months it would take him even to see his house in the lower Ninth Ward. McClendon lived one block from Flood Street in a city where the Army Corps of Engineers had its main offices on Leek Avenue. That should have told me something right there, McClendon said. But like my mama was always telling me, I wasn't always so good at listening. He was a squat, dark-skinned black man with Popeye forearms and a fireplug physique. His voice, proper and refined, suggested a thespian past, but his education stopped after high school when he took a job laying cable for the phone company. McClendon was 29 years old when he fell from a ladder and fractured several discs in his back. Permanent disability would pay him 2/3 of his salary for life. He spent most of the next decade bouncing around the country, but returned to the lower ninth just before his 40th birthday. I realized I needed three things in life, McClendon said. Good food, good people, good music, and no place I looked at offered as good a combination as New Orleans. McClendon ran his own small salvage yard in the years leading up to Katrina. Mostly, he spent his time restoring antique cars. He'd buy junkers for a few $100s, if not the price of a tow, and then haunt the antique car shows in search of parts. You can make 10 times the money you put into them, McClendon said. But you drive them and think about how much work you put into it, and you don't want to ever let them go. He was up to 14 cars at the time of Katrina. The floodwaters destroyed all of them. None of them were insured. The house he owned on Caffin Avenue in the Lower Ninth proved a bigger blow. It wasn't much to look at from the street, a narrow, two-story place with a plain exterior. But McClendon knew he was looking at his dream home the first time he stepped inside. The old house had wood floors, high ceilings, crown moldings, and a pair of tiled fireplaces. With 4 bedrooms upstairs, it was a lot more house than a single divorcee needed, but he had 8 kids, and though all of them were grown, he liked that he could offer them a sanctuary if they ever needed it. He paid $72,000 for this handsome old home only a couple of blocks from the Mississippi. He redid the floors downstairs and restored all the wood molding and baseboards. He installed new cabinets in the kitchen and spent weeks working on the old wooden banister leading up to the second floor. In July 2005, 1 month before Katrina, he rounded up several friends to help him move furniture. He had finished work on the first level and was moving everything downstairs to start work on the second. Had I reversed it, McClendon said, I would have saved just about everything. Instead, 5 feet of flood water sat in his home in the weeks after Katrina, and he lost everything but a duffel bag of clothes. He had survived, unlike hundreds of his neighbors, but sitting alone in his lousy hotel room, he said, I really felt like there was a personal vendetta against me. McClendon put his name on the waiting list for a FEMA trailer. He jumped when, after about 6 months, the agency offered him a trailer in Slidell, more than 30 miles from his home. The first anniversary of Katrina came and passed before FEMA delivered a trailer to his property on Caffin. Home was now a 300-square-foot white rectangle with water that never quite got hot enough, but he was back in the Lower Ninth, gutting his home. It felt like forward motion. Still, sifting through the remains of his life, he couldn't help but feel sorry for himself. What's it like to lose everything overnight? He asked. I can tell you. In a culture in which our possessions can define us, he continued, he had nothing. Only later, sitting in his bare office in a strange-shaped, multicolored building he dubbed the Lower Ninth Ward Village Community Center, lighting up yet another cool as executive director of the refuge he had created, could McClendon declare, Katrina is the best thing to ever happen to me. People working with Common Ground, the volunteer group that Malik Rahim founded in the days after Katrina, posted hand-painted street signs around the community. That way, at least they knew where they were when driving around the Lower Ninth. Confrontations over the city's aggressive demolition plans were now being fought in the courts rather than on people's front lawns. The Episcopals staked an important flag in the community around a year after Katrina, when they sanctioned the Lower Ninth's first house of worship. The Church of All Souls first met in a parishioner's garage, but soon moved into a building that had been used by a big discount drugstore chain. St. Walgreens, people called it, or the Walgreens Church. Brad Pitt started showing up in the Lower Ninth after Katrina. The star had first fallen in love with New Orleans while there in 1994 to work on Interview with the Vampire, The Vampire Chronicles. Everything was sexy and sultry, he said. I'd ride my bike all over the place, amazed by the architecture. I'd return to New Orleans every chance I could. He was in Calgary shooting a new Jesse James movie when Katrina hit, but a few weeks later, he was in New York attending the first Clinton Global Initiative. That proved all the inspiration this self-described architecture junkie needed. Pitt reached out to William McDonough, a leading voice in the sustainability movement, and teamed up with the group Global Green USA, which had already started doing work in the Lower Ninth. There is a real opportunity here to lead the nation in a direction it needs to be going, and that is building efficiently, Pitt said at a press conference 11 months after Katrina. He put up $200,000 to fund an international design competition in search of architects that would help build environmentally friendly, storm-safe homes in the Lower Ninth. The Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Elementary School sat derelict on Claiborne Avenue, a half dozen blocks from the levee breach. The school had been deluged with so much water that dead fish were found on the second floor. King lost 10 students in the flooding and 20 of its parents. A family of four lived a few blocks from the school, two honor students and parents active in the PTA. All four perished that day. King Elementary was relatively new in the Lower Ninth, barely a decade old at the time of Katrina, yet it was beloved by parents. Even as 96% of its students qualified for a subsidized or free lunch, its kids scored well on standardized tests. A big reason for their success was Dory Hicks, a commanding black woman who had grown up in the neighborhood. Hicks had been the principal of King since the day it opened its doors. Hicks was in Dallas after the storm. Her staff was scattered everywhere. They had been fired en masse after Katrina, but less than 2 months after the flood, a group of them started to meet. Hicks flew to New Orleans from Dallas once a month. A third grade teacher named James Mack drove from Cincinnati. As a group, they were generally hostile to charter schools. Before the storm, Hicks herself had declared them the demise of public education. But their priority was reopening their school, and the new state-created recovery school district made plain they looked more favorably on those claiming the charter banner. So the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Charter School for Science and Technology was born. Hicks signed up 95% of her old staff and put Hilda Young in charge of the board of directors they formed. With more than 30 years with the Orleans Parish School District, Young had worked both as a principal and in the district's central office. Her job was to secure them the state certification they would need before they could open their doors. The only school approved for a charter at the time without the help of an outside management group or nonprofit organization, wrote Education Week's Leslie Maxwell. King received its certification in March 2006. They had a building, their old elementary school on Claiborne. The question was what shape it was in. Not trusting the new recovery school district to tell them, Hicks called someone she knew at the Washington Group, an engineering firm in Denver that did work in New Orleans and had established a relationship with King Elementary. They send in a team of people, and a week and a half later, I have this detailed report, Hicks said. The building needed a lot of work, but the firm declared it structurally sound and worth saving. It didn't matter. The people who ran the recovery school district deemed the building a hazard and ordered it razed. Their attitude was, "The mayor is going to green space the neighborhood anyway," Hilda Young said. That's when we realized they didn't want us to open. If they were going to save their school, they were going to have to do it themselves. Two policemen were standing in front of the school on a March morning, 7 months after Katrina. That's how Hicks knew someone had tipped the district off about their plans. A padlock was also on the school door. But Hicks, who stood more than 6 feet tall, wasn't backing down. She had her engineer's report and the support of Marlon Gussman, the parish's sheriff. Besides, she had lined up around 250 volunteers, most of them from Common Ground, and they had a job to do. "We just cut those big padlocks off all the doors," Hicks said, "and everybody got to work." The police would kick them out several times during the 4 days it took to gut the school, but the cleanup crews would simply wait an hour or two before sneaking back so they could continue their work. The parents of nearly 1,000 kids signed up to attend King in the fall of 2006. The old building on Claiborne wouldn't be ready for the new school year, but the district promised them a middle school in the upper ninth that had been shuttered even before the storm. The building would be ready by mid-August, district officials promised, which is when Hicks wanted to start classes. Closer to the date, the district told Hicks they would need to wait until September 7th. Even then, Hicks found a school with moldy walls and peeling paint. The rodents were probably saying, "You moving into our school?" Hicks said. They were running around like they owned the place. King held its first day of classes on the school's front steps. "We broke kids into sections. Kindergarten, first graders," Hicks said. "Teachers had lessons, gave homework. Hot breakfast every day, hot lunch. I wanted the world to see. We're ready to educate our children of color. But we seem to be the only ones who cared about really doing that." A few days later, the district found them an alternative building, an elementary school uptown that had suffered only modest roof damage, but in a majority white neighborhood. "We were very grateful," Hicks said. "We put letters in the mailboxes of all our neighbors, introducing ourselves and saying thank you for your hospitality. Everyone was very, very nice." The best news from her perspective was that the district now had ample reason to find King a more permanent home in what one school official delicately called a more demographically suitable neighborhood. Education officials operating out of Baton Rouge put King on the priority list it shared with the Corps. Hicks and her people wouldn't spend even a full year uptown before the district delivered them the keys to the old place on Claiborne, now painted yellow with purple trim. It looked even better than it did before the storm. A few months after she started working with Will Hood, Connie Udo asked him to compare Lakeview to Iraq. She wanted to hear about people worse off than they were. Hood laughed and said there was no comparison. "You look so much worse," he said. "Worse?" a startled Udo asked. "Connie, Iraq is a few bombed out buildings. When we blow up a bridge in Iraq, we fix it. And guess what? I can Skype from Iraq. Here, you can't even get a freaking phone line." That night, she shared her exchange with Hood with her husband. She had conjured up the worst war zone her mind could imagine. But Mark told her, of course, Lakeview looked more battered than Fallujah or Tikrit. I remember feeling sick to my stomach, she said. Nothing had changed, but she now felt overwhelmed. Udo already had the phone numbers for several tree cutters from her months of running a beacon of hope out of her home. She knew whom to contact to haul away a flooded car. The challenge was gathering more numbers. It's like a scavenger hunt after a disaster, Udo said. How do I get that tree off my roof? What do I do with my car? How do you make sure the mold doesn't come back? I hear there are all these volunteers, but where do I find them? The advantage of the recovery center she was running was that she'd only need to answer each of those questions once. We called ourselves the second responders, she said. Udo proved resourceful. People complained that living in a FEMA trailer or perched on a second floor meant they had no way to wash their clothes. So Udo used a small part of her budget to create a laundry room in a double wide in the church parking lot. She set up computers for visitors to use and made sure they had enough shovels, wheelbarrows, and other tools for both volunteers and homeowners needing to borrow them. She also came up with a solution to contractor fraud. You had people coming into town slapping a magnet sign on their car and saying, "Hi, I'm a contractor. Give me $30,000 and I'll get started on your house," and that's the last you'd hear from them. So Udo started a version of Angie's List. Plumbers, electricians, carpenters, and others who were bonded, certified, and endorsed by neighbors. Volunteers who wanted to help Lakeview called, but not if it meant sleeping on the ground in the Good News camp. So Father Hood found her 25 army cots, and they converted the upstairs of St. Paul's Homecoming Center into volunteer housing. Udo had plenty of help. Another 5 beacons had opened across Lakeview. There was also Lakeview Civic and Freddie Yoder's army of block captains. We counted everything, Yoder said. Sunken streets, recessed curbs, manholes, catch basins, you name it. If there was any damage to the infrastructure of the community, we documented it. They'd meet every Thursday to plot the damage on grid maps of Lakeview and prepare reports that Yoder would pass along to the city's Public Works Department. Udo also had the help of a woman everyone called Miss Rita, Rita LeGrand. LeGrand, 70, and her husband, 75, had moved back to Lakeview a few months after the Udos in April 2006. She helped Freddie Yoder organize the precinct captain system and eventually took over Lakeview Civic's Blight Committee. It was her job to police her fellow homeowners and go after those not taking care of their property. The city council had given communities a powerful tool when it passed, 8 months after the storm, the Good Neighbor Plan. Under Good Neighbor, homeowners who had not gutted their home by the one-year anniversary of Katrina were technically in violation of the law. The bill was championed by Lakeview's representative on the city council. It's Good Neighbor that we used to pressure people into making a decision, LeGrand said. Let other communities fret over the rights of the displaced and worry that their neighbors needed more time to repair a home. I'd really push people, LeGrand said. I'd tell them, fix it up or sell it. You have to make up your mind. And if they still failed to act, she'd invoke Good Neighbor. We started going to City Hall and pushing to have hearings, LeGrand said. I'm very good
at aggravating people when I have to. New Orleans seemed stalled as 2006 turned into 2007. On the 8th floor of City Hall, where once the clerks were issuing 400 residential building permits a day, now they were averaging maybe 50. The determined pioneers, who had either the money or the grit, had moved home, but everyone else seemed to be in Baton Rouge or Houston or with relatives in Cincinnati or Phoenix. A second family moved back to Udo Street a year after Katrina, but 6 months later, they were still the only two families on their block. "You brought me here to help Lakeview rebuild," Udo groused to fatherhood. "But instead, I'm spending all my time cleaning up." Udo used trees to lift people's spirits and perhaps her own. She knew little about landscaping, so she turned to Al Petrie, who headed Lakeview Civic's Beautification Committee. Petrie used his connections in the oil and gas business to raise $75,000 to start a tree fund. Teams of volunteers did the planting, including around a dozen West Point cadets who spent their spring break in New Orleans. Crews started digging on Upper Canal Street, planting live oaks, slash pines, bald cypress, and other trees. People would honk their horn. They'd raise their fists out the window, Udo said. People would stop their car, get out, and cry. It meant a lot. Meanwhile, Udo and everyone else in flooded New Orleans struggled with the road home application process. "It took a master's degree to figure out the forms," Udo said. She eventually convinced Road Home to send a counselor to her center once a week. "Every week, we'd have a line out the door," she said. The better she got to know the Road Home representative, the more dispirited she would feel. "Policies are inconsistent," the woman confided in Udo. "Every day, something changes. And then you have some employees saying one thing and some saying something else." People who had once struck Udo as eager to move home were giving up. Even some of those who were back home seemed to be losing their nerve. "They tell me it was the neighbors that made them love Lakeview," Udo said. "But now the only neighbors they have are the rats and possums and raccoons living in the blighted houses all around them." The Road Home program, as conceived, was simple. Road Home would make up the difference up to $150,000 between the pre-storm worth of a home and the insurance payments people received. There were caveats. A homeowner who lived in a flood zone but failed to carry flood insurance was penalized. Those choosing to walk away from a property were sent a smaller check than those who committed to rebuilding. But for those rebuilding, the math was easy. If a couple received $220,000 in insurance payments for a home an assessor appraised at $300,000 prior to Katrina, they would receive a Road Home check for $80,000. Blanco insisted that Rita victims be included in Road Home. "I'm governor," she said. "Am I going to say to people hit by Rita, you were in the wrong storm? Sorry." She also decided to hire an outside firm to administer the program. There was this constant chatter, this repetition that Louisiana is corrupt, Blanco said. She wouldn't give Washington more excuses for holding up the state's money. In June 2006, the state hired ICF International to decide how much each homeowner would get. The price tag for ICF's services was a staggering $900 million. That was more revenue than the company had booked in the previous 4 years combined.
this consulting firm that boasted of the work it did for the federal government and global oil companies was based 1,000 miles away in Virginia, explaining a travel budget of $19 million. A month before securing the Road Home deal, ICF filed to go public. So on top of everything else, the executives put in charge of what was being billed as the largest housing recovery program in the country's history were distracted by an impending IPO. By summer 2006, more than 80,000 people had submitted a Road Home claim. By year's end, 123,000 had applied. Every Road Home applicant was photographed and fingerprinted. ICF blamed the policy on the anti-fraud guidelines established by the LRA. Nagin brayed that the company was treating people like criminals. A state senator from Baton Rouge named Cleo Fields facetiously suggested that the company should take a DNA swab from every homeowner. The fingerprints were only an early safeguard in a process that Daniel Rothschild, a researcher with the Mercatus Center, a conservative policy group at George Mason University, found had 57 steps until ICF trimmed it to a 43-step process. ICF would demand documents that a drowned-out homeowner wouldn't reasonably be expected to have. Everyone seemed to know someone who'd submitted a thick packet of supporting materials only to be told that ICF couldn't find it. In November 2006, Cassandra Wall and a couple of her sisters took part in a protest in Baton Rouge to demand the state do better. 15 months after Katrina and 6 months after the company had taken charge of Road Home, ICF had disbursed all of $700,000 to 18 homeowners. Blanco exacted a promise from ICF to inform at least 10,000 homeowners by month's end of the dollar amount they would be receiving. ICF did, and then sent out thousands of follow-up letters apologizing for informing an applicant of the wrong grant amount. Road Home, or Road Block, the New Orleans Tribune asked on its cover that month. In December, the legislature held hearings looking into Road Home. Only a paltry 84 homeowners had received a check. Legislators expressed their frustrations over a program that, from the outside, didn't seem complex. Verify that people are whom they claim to be and that they, in fact, owned the property they were claiming. Check with the assessor's office to see what a house was worth prior to the storm, or use some of the hundreds of millions of dollars the state was paying the company to hire its own appraisers. The insurance payments could be confirmed by checking industry records. Both the House and Senate passed resolutions directing the governor to fire ICF International. The vote in the House was 97-1. No one was more frustrated by Road Home than Charmaine Marchand, who for 3 days camped out on the Capitol lawn to draw attention to her grievances. She lamented all the money the state could have saved and the locals that could have been put to work if the state had run the program out of its community development program. Instead, ICF is flying its out-of-town people to Louisiana, racking up bills, Marchand said, and also boasting about all the money it would be making off Road Home in the documents it filed to go public. Blanco convinced Marchand to take down her tent by inviting her and other New Orleans legislators to the governor's mansion for a meeting with Michael Byrne, the former Homeland Security official ICF had put in charge of Road Home. I share the frustrations of our people and the legislature, but common sense must prevail, Blanco said. This isn't a time to start from scratch. which would make people wait even longer. Byrne vowed that they'd soon be sending out 500 checks a day. Again, ICF fell well short of its promises. In February, California Congresswoman Maxine Waters brought her housing subcommittee to New Orleans for a hearing on Road Home. "I'm on the phone every day pushing for solutions," Blanco testified. At least the governor could reach someone with ICF. Others testified about their difficulties even reaching anyone connected with Road Home. A recorded message greeted callers with a promise to return any message within 48 hours. Except Michael Byrne confessed that winter that ICF hadn't hired enough people to follow up on that promise. Blanco was up for re-election that fall, November 2007. Smelling blood, Bobby Jindal declared his candidacy that January, setting up a rematch of their 2003 race. 2 months later, Blanco gathered her staff together to tell them she wouldn't be running for re-election. "I am choosing to do what I believe to be best for the state," the governor declared in a televised address. She had already raised $3 million in campaign funds, but polls showed her with only 35% of the vote in a head-to-head race with Jindal. This may be the first time in history that a non-term limited governor decided to step down rather than seek re-election, declared Pearson Cross, a political science professor at the University of Louisiana Lafayette. The only comparison Cross could conjure up was LBJ's decision to drop out of the 1968 presidential race because of Vietnam. In May, Mary Landrieu invited Connie Udo to Washington to talk about Road Home at the Senate's Ad Hoc Subcommittee on Disaster Recovery. Only 10% of the Road Home applicants had received a check, but a top Blanco aide announced that Road Home was on pace to run out of money long before every eligible homeowner received a payment. "I'm Exhibit A of the problem confronting New Orleans 21 months after Katrina," Udo told the senators. "I'm the cheerleader who keeps telling people to hang in there," she said. Yet even the captain of the pom-pom club confessed that she was wrestling with despair. At least one set of government functionaries were on the job, the bureaucrats in City Hall overseeing the list of condemned properties. In July 2007, the city published so many 30-day notices on homes deemed a serious, imminent, and continuing threat to the public health, safety, and welfare that the list filled 25 pages in the Times-Picayune. "We don't want to demolish anything if the owner is taking action," a city attorney explained. "But the onus is on the property owner." Feeling frustrated by the constant delays, FEMA officials had told the city that the agency wouldn't pay the demolition costs for any home after August 29, 2007, the 2-year anniversary of Katrina. Bulldozing a home and carting away the debris could cost anywhere between $6,000 and $10,000. City officials were determined to knock down as many as they could before the federal government's deadline. The city kept one list. FEMA kept another. For the demolition crews, it kept under contract. Getting your home off one didn't necessarily get it off both. Adabel Joshua was a 79-year-old disabled widow temporarily living 150 miles from the two-story brick home she owned in the Lower Ninth Ward. Joshua had spent more than $5,000 gutting and cleaning her place. She even stopped by City Hall in early July, where two employees, she said, assured her that her house was safe. Yet 2 days later, a nephew phoned Joshua with the bad news.
he had stopped by to mow the lawn. The house was gone. The Wall Street Journal told Joshua's story in a page one article by Rick Brooks. The reporter seemed to have little trouble finding people shocked to learn their property was on a demolition list. A man named Michael DeZura told Brooks about a building he was fixing up. It would have been reduced to rubble, DeZura said, if a friend hadn't called him in Houston to let him know a city crew was disconnecting the utilities. Mary Harrison had already put a new roof on her home and had people working on the wiring and the plumbing when she heard from a neighbor that a demolition order had been slapped on her door. She spoke to people at City Hall and then phoned FEMA, but no one could help her. "They can't find me on the list to take me off," she said.
Context of white supremacy. That will do it for the audio for this week. We should pick up next week. And we ended chapter 20. We just ended chapter 20. So next week we'll pick up right at the beginning of chapter 21. Eight chapters left in the book and we'll be all done. I think max will be done. We should have four more of these. So we should finish this up next month and then move on to the next book. But that should do it for the audio today. If you would like to share again, we have the temporary number. Hopefully the problem will be corrected and we should be up and rolling again tomorrow, hopefully, white people permitting. But at minimum, just for today, the number that you can use if you want to call in to share any thoughts on what you heard from the audio this week is 712-770-4010. And the code is 425-022-POUND. So the number again, 712-770-4010. And the code is 425-022-POUND. And in fact, you don't have to press star 6. I think at least for the temporary number that we're using, you can just dial in and your line should be unmuted. And if you have commentary to share, you will be with us. And I can just manually mute your line if you're just calling in to listen. That's it. All the folks that dialed in with a hand up should be with us. If you all have comments to share, feel free. Everybody that dialed in, line should be open.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Dustin. Greetings to all the callers and the listeners. I missed basically almost the whole first segment because of the whole snafu previously. So that's why I didn't comment earlier. But just from what we just read or what you just read recently, you can't really not acknowledge that this is a system. When you see all of these different agencies involved in just not answering people's questions. I mean, just now, the lady, they couldn't find this lady's name on the list, but they're going to demolish her home. Like, you can't go through a list and read her name, and then she's calling all these other different agencies to see if she can get assistance, and no one's available to answer her call. This is, like, probably the only ethnic cleansing that was probably worse than this that I know of is Tasmania, where they killed everybody down to the last person. This is just sick. And these people are out of control, and I think you've made this abundantly clear that if anyone wants to understand that this is a complete system with everybody working in tandem to just ruin and destroy black lives, and we have like no value. We're less than the dirt, Dookie, you can name it. I mean, like, they treat us like animals. And, I mean, this section of the book just really brings that home in a way that the whole book brings it home. And that's all I have for now. But I just think that this is sick. And I think anyone should just study Katrina if you really want to understand the totality of how the system works and how all of these different individuals, as well as all of these different agencies, work in tandem to basically ruin black life wherever we are. Thank you.
Did you have any difficulty calling in before the problem started on the first segment?
No, actually, I called in, and in the beginning it was fine. Oh, I forget at what point it dropped out, but once it dropped out, it thoroughly dropped out. Like, I called in multiple times, I couldn't get through, and then eventually I ended up I had trouble even getting in on the flash phone at first, and then I got to the flash phone, and then I actually called in. Once you emailed me back, I called in again. And what was playing on the flash phone was, I think, a few steps behind the live program or vice versa. So after a while, I just had to cut off the flash phone and just listen on the live program. So, that's pretty much the experience that I had. I don't know what other callers' experiences were.
Got it. Hopefully that'll be corrected tomorrow. We will see what white people do. Any of the other folks that dialed in, you'll have comments you want to get in? I'll assume folks are listening in.
Can you hear?
Yes, sir.
Thomas Smith from New York. Excuse me. I just want to have a few comments. And from the first segment, from what I got, you know, I went down on Mr. White, Megan's best friend at one point, he turned on him, another person who you need to reach out to try to get on the show. And, I know it'd be impossible, but from the second segment, I'm Brad Pitt. I wish you could get him on the show. just what the other caller said, man, it was just a travesty. You know, I'm going to have to go back because I missed a lot of the middle. I caught the beginning and I caught the end. I'm a little hoarse. Maybe I'm getting a cold. It's a little weather change on me. But in that segment where they were talking about the school, Martin Luther King School, and I saw that on, like, I think it was that CNN program where they were pretty much talking about, you know, education. Well, it might have been Black in America, and they focused on the schools and the charters. And how they police locked the people out. They were dedicated, man. They'll go in and start gutting the building out, but, you know, the police have removed them. And then they'll go back to it, and eventually, I guess they just let them do it, but as long as they get it under their rules. And, just reading this book, it's just, like the guy said, points out how the system is totally in place. And he also pointed out to me that this was planned well in advance. That these people ain't coming back, and we have a plan B, like, that we could run right away. And that's all I have to say. about the book, when the call dropped, I was walking to the store here, and I saw all these police cars and fire trucks and ambulances. And I live on the corner of my street, and I live on 148th Street, and between 148th and 147th Street in Frederick Douglass or 8th Avenue, there's a huge precinct for housing. So, you know, I knew it had nothing to do with them. And as I got closer, I could smell like a little fire. But everything just looked so fake, and people were telling me to move this way, and I realized they were filming a movie. And there was about two ambulances, all these fire trucks. So when I got to the next corner, which was 145th Street, there's a Chinese guy who was delivering someone's food, and he was on a scooter. And a car hit him. This guy's passed. I mean, he was dead to me, laying there on the street. And everyone just, you know, started taking pictures and everything. And two cops jumped out on the scene and kind of tried to control the thing. And, you know, 15 minutes later, still no ambulance. But yet, they had two ambulances right there at the movie set a block away. So I just said, unbelievable, man. End of my little story. Thank you.
Well, make sure you take care of yourself. Another illustration, racism, white supremacy, and allocation of resources. Major surprise there, in my opinion. Any of the other folks that are listening in have comments, or you all just listening? Right on. Assume folks are just listening in. Some of the things that stood out with the school, I think I had said yesterday that was going to come up, another example of race soldiers being used to disrupt, obfuscate, impede the education of black children. I also thought it was significant because they said that they were using some of the common ground workers, and we talked about them last week, the folks that were working with Malik Raheem, black male, former Black Panther Party member, and I was just thinking, like, wow, for them to go and be that defiant, like, you know, we're going to cut the locks off and, you know, you kick us out, we'll come back an hour or two later. If, you know, they had already said that most of the people working with Common Ground were white, if these had not been white people, just how would they have been treated? Would they have called a SWAT team to the school to forcibly evict all of these workers and, you know, demand, make sure that they stop working on this black school for these black children? Huge, in my opinion, illustration of black self-respect. I guess Deborah Hicks might be somebody that would be good to speak with. Seems like she did just a monumental effort in getting this school back and just would not be denied the opportunity to get back. And I think even though they did get this school back, it just further illustrated the massive amount of problems, and they just had no intention of correcting things so that black people could return. Because she was saying, I've heard her do interviews, and she was saying that they were just swamped with, you know, parents and trying to get their children in school, and it was simply not possible. I mean, they're not big enough. No school is big enough to take every single child in the city, and they were just saying that it was so painful to have to tell parents, you know, we're at our max. We just can't accept any more children. We don't have room. We don't have desks. We don't have the resources to take any more children, and seeing folks suffering and saying, man, what can we do? There's no schools. In my view, major contrast to what was happening over in Lakeview and some of these other white areas. One of the footnotes in this chapter, they have one about shots on the bridge, but that's a whole nother incident to itself. One of the footnotes, it's about the insurance aspect, where he said that the insurance companies, they had a banner year where they made so much money after all this. The footnote reads, delay, deny, defend. That's how a Rutgers professor named J.M. Feynman, a white male, described the insurance industry's strategy in a book by that title published several years after Katrina. The strategy, Feynman reported, had been laid out in a PowerPoint presentation that came to light during a lawsuit against Allstate when a policyholder files a claim, the aggressive insurance company makes a low offer, a McKinney and Company consultant explained, let people fight if they think they deserve more. And I thought that was hugely important when you get context where you've got black people who have lost everything, many of them, may have, including, you know, relatives, people that you care about who died and what have you and were never identified, or bodies were never found, and all the everything else that went along with that. You might end up 150 miles away. Maybe you're in Texas. Maybe you're in Georgia. Maybe you're in Utah, wherever you get thrown to. And now you've got to come back and battle for road home and battle for this. People like to say that. They throw that, oh, you just battle and endure and just do it. That's not logical. Everybody has a breaking point. And particularly, I mean, anybody, you put enough stress on them and they can crack where you just don't have the ability to fight and grapple. And I mean, with some of this, you heard with Alden McDonald and his brother, where, you know, they ended up having to go to court and get a lawyer. If you're a black person, maybe you don't have the resources to get an attorney and go after these insurance companies. Maybe you don't have the means to sit around and wrangle with them for a year or 2 years to fight to get. And they even use the term to get a fair settlement. just designed to take it to. And I know that they will come out and say, well, it was a lot of white people who, you know, they didn't get the correct amount for the insurance as well. Again, this was not, taking the words directly out of Mr. Rivlin's mouth, this was not an equal opportunity storm. Disproportionately, if you were a black person, you were more likely to lose your house, to have major damage, or your apartment. They talked about the renter section this week as well. Let's see, some of the other things that popped out. Again, they keep putting the Udo family in. I remind people from last week where this woman had direct line to Senator Mary Landrieu. I haven't heard a single black person in here. They didn't say that about Alden McDonald, that he'd had a direct line to a state, or excuse me, to a U.S. senator, not a state senator, a U.S. senator, to, you know, let them know what problems I'm having with the bank and difficulties here, and what can you do to help things out. I don't have any sympathy. And just from what I've read in the book, it just seems like a vastly different world for these white folks in Lakeview or even in St. Bernard's Parish, even though we haven't heard as much about them at this point, where she's getting people cutting her checks so she can go set up a laundry facility. People can get their clothes washed and get online and rent out tools and all this stuff. And I don't hear any of that going on in the Lower Ninth or New Orleans East, where predominantly black people are. Let's see. The sentence I thought was could be an act of racism. He said that Nagin Braid, that the company was treating people like criminals. And this is about the ICF, when they were requiring people to submit fingerprints and jump through all these hoops to prove their identity, and that they did actually own the property that they were making a claim for. The definition for braid is the loud, harsh cry of a donkey or mule. I might even insert jackass. I think that's an interesting way to reference, at the time, Mayor Nagin's response, that he brayed about something. That might be a sentence I might have to question Mr. Rivlin about when he comes to the program. The road home, I think there's going to be more about that. The racism within that program, I think, is going to come out later. I don't want to hop ahead, but that's one you can just highlight, tick, wait for later, because there's more deliberate. Some of it you already heard. Alden McDonald, I think I mentioned it at the time, where he talked about how he knew this was going to just totally ruin black people, that they were not going to be compensated correctly, and this would be another impediment that was going to block them from being able to come back and restructure their lives, reconstruct their lives. So you can just kick that. I'm sure that'll come up later in the book. Let's see some of the other things that came out. The demolition, I got that article in the Wall Street Journal where they were talking about just going through and knocking down these people's residences. Mr. Getridge, when we did the program with June Cross, her documentary, The Old Man in the Storm, he had his house that he and his wife lived in, and then he had some other properties. He lost his other properties where he went and fought. I think it was the same thing. He went down, talked to the people. Okay, we got you, Mr. Getridge. We're going to take your house off the list. And then, but whoops, on a different list. Sorry, lost that one. Oh, well, nothing you can do about it. Standard operating procedure, the same disregard. And again, with the loss of life, they have video. I think one of them is in, I believe it's When the Levees Broke, Spike Lee's film, where they're going to demolish a residence that looks like it needs to be demolished. It looks like it is definitely beyond being saved. But the point was that there were remains. They had dogs that come in, right, and they do the smelling to see if there's a body that might be inside, and the dogs were alerting that there was a body inside, but they couldn't find it. And they said, you know, we can't locate it, and the house is, looks like it could fall over. It's kind of dangerous. We can't really go inside and inspect, but it does seem that there are human remains in this residence. We can't get them out. You know, nothing we can do about it. We got to tear it down and, you know, say a prayer or whatever, have a moment of silence. But I'm sure there was a lot of that that happened in this process, because there were so, and I mean tons of reports of people coming back to houses that had the markings that they had been checked, and then you go inside and there's a body. So I'm sure that a lot of remains of black folks got tossed in this process of them just going willy-nilly and knocking down these residences. Let's see. Yeah, with the school, with them dragging their feet and breaking these promises, we'll have it done in time for you to start the school year. And then they get there and they have to have class out on the front steps. I just have a difficult time imagining white students, white children going through the same process, them having to start school out on the front steps. That is, that's just a total disgrace, in my opinion. I'm sure they could have found something much much better. And then the facility that they do find that they can work with is in a predominantly white neighborhood. Let's see. Other things, the FEMA trailers, I'm sure that'll pop up as we continue rolling. Brad Pitt got to have the well-meaning white people to insert themselves. Just want to help you all out. Although I have heard from quite a few black people, I think it's reported that they constructed, Brad Pitt and his organization, that they constructed well over 100 residents and residences. And I've heard from some of the black homeowners that he is reported to have assisted, that they're very happy. They got their house. It's very affordable payments, and they really appreciate the help that they got. But again, white people, racist man, racist woman, racist child, they are in the best position to help because of racism, white supremacy. Let's see. Covered the insurance point. Daenerys Shavers, we covered that, the violence. There were a lot of people that predicted it. In fact, I recall Malik Raheem, where he's been talking about all this as somebody I would love to get on the program. But he had been saying, when you have young children, there were so many images, so much video footage of young black children, 5 years old, 6 years, even younger than that in some instances. But you got all these young children who've just been left out here. You didn't save them. They got stuck at the Superdome, stuck at the convention center, or stuck at their residence and what have you, that we've been reading about this whole time. They witnessed all this. Oh, black life doesn't mean anything. Oh, okay. Got it. The trauma that you go through, there are whole books that have been written about this. Children of Katrina, that just came out last month, and talking about the PTSD and how it affected these young black children. No surprise. I'm sure white people already knew that was probably going to happen too. You already had people that were in an extremely impoverished condition. You take them through all this, and now they don't get counseling. They just get shipped off to Houston or Utah and thought of as a looter, or you know, deadbeat, no good, no count black people need to go back to Louisiana and get out of our town. I'm not surprised that they would just be, oh, whatever, we're just going to go out here and do whatever we want to. If that means we go out and shoot up the whole block, oh well. Daenerys Shavers, the black male, I played the audio segment at the beginning of the program, the black person that is alleged to have shot him was 15 at the time of the shooting. He would have been, I think, at most 13 when Hurricane Katrina hit. I think Malik Raheem, you can go back and listen to his interview, I think he hit it exactly to the point that this is not rocket science. This is the behavior of people who feel that their life doesn't mean anything and they have no regard for any other black life either as a result of what they went through with all of this. The storm, the breach of the levees, armed white people coming in and occupying the city and denying access to quality resources. So just a confluence of all of that, I'm sure, led to a lot of damaged black children, black parents, just a wealth of black people who've really been harmed by all this. Yeah, them reneging on the prophets. I think there was a lot of this, too. There's a lot of video of these white people, like the white folks they mentioned at ICF, who racked up. I said looting. I think Mr. Demi Ford mentioned that last week when we heard about Mr. Yoder. He came in and is cleaning up on all these properties, getting them on the cheap and then building them up. And now he has a home that's almost worth $1 million that he got for a few nickels, coming in and ravaging the city after it was all messed up. But these white people coming in, they get these contracts and what have you, a lot of these no-bid contracts, and then ICF, they're supposed to come in and manage, make sure there's no fraud with the Road Home program, and they're cleaning up. They're not even getting out checks in it. They can't even return a phone call in a timely manner, but they're bragging, man, we are cleaning up. We are raking in millions and millions of dollars. There was tons of this throughout Katrina. That's why I insist, if you want to talk about looting, forget, you know, some black people out in the street. I wouldn't care what they took. If it was a flat screen television, if it was socks, if it was water, gas, anything, whatever they took, it pales in comparison to what white people took during, after this whole event. I mean, it is staggering. The amount of looting that went on in terms of what white people were doing and continue to do in Louisiana and New Orleans specifically. With that, oh, and Mr. McClendon, I got to make sure I get that in, because I had a listener who was basically saying that he felt unhappy because he was still with his parent. And I said, man, in the system of white supremacy, if you have a parent who has a place and, you know, you all aren't arguing. It's not like there's beef or anything, but you have a place to say that's great. There's tons of people who do that, white people and non-white people. That's nothing to feel bad about at all. You should be happy you have a spot to stay and a mom that, you know, cares about you and looks out for your best interest. That really made me feel good hearing Mr. McClendon, well, I guess not that good, but him saying before the storm when he got this house and it was two stories and had all these extra bedrooms, and him saying, hey, my children, they are older now, but I appreciate having a spot where they can come and stay if things go bad, if they need it, bam, they got a place to stay. I think that is outstanding as a black parent, outstanding black self-respect, and reminded me of what the caller said. Again, unfortunately, the storm came in and ruined all that, but definitely thought that was noteworthy, and glad that came up in this section of the book this week. With that... Yeah, I'm sure there's going to be more on St. Bernard. Oh, there was the footnote on St. Bernard's Parish about the lawsuit. I'll read that, and then if no one else has anything, we can go ahead and wrap with St. Bernard's Parish. A federal judge found that the ordinance in St. Bernard's Parish, where they were blocking people, black people attempting to move into their area, the ordinance violated federal anti-discrimination law. St. Bernard's Parish was forced to pay fines and court costs exceeding $1.8 million. And there's a lot more information on that. I think Melissa Harris Perry's husband might be involved in this. I think, I know he's given talks about this. They live in the Louisiana area, if not in New Orleans, very close. And I think he's been very involved in fighting against racism, particularly with regard to housing for black people. I think he has quite a bit of information. I'm trying to get a little bit more from her husband, who has been on her show quite a few times. Unless any of the folks that are listening in, unless you all had anything else you wanted to get in before we wrap.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I had two things. I was saying for the brother who was kind of, I guess, disappointed about having to live at home with his mom, it's so crazy because in traditional African culture, the whole family lives together. You know, you have your grandparents, parents, aunts, uncles, everybody lives in the same compound and takes care of each other. So to me, I agree with you. He should actually feel very good that his parents were in condition to just kick him out of 18 and tell him to fend for himself. That's a very, traditionally African way of doing things as far as taking care of your child, even if they're in a situation that's not palatable for them financially. The other thing is, that Brad Pitt thing really really just made me mad. And the reason why is because, you know, these white people are straight up like the architects of every aspect of our misery, especially when we're dealing with the change. Every aspect of their misery was like puppet mastered by these white people. Then they take a famous white guy and they put him, and it's the Jesus Christ effect. They put him down there, he's building these hundreds of homes, and then it's like worship the white people. First, you know, the storm creates this destruction. White people are the architects of everyone being basically mistreated, robbed, subjugated in every way, shape, or form. And then after that, you send in the white guy to save the day. So in other words, we're going to abuse you, then make you worship us by sending Brad Pitt, you know, or Sean Penn, or whichever other famous white person they want to use for that particular day in order to make black people think that, oh, white people care, you know, Brad Pitt cares. He's building, you know, 100 homes. And it's just crazy. And, like, we have to start really stepping back and taking a holistic look at our history with these people, because they become more and more sophisticated and more refined with every incident that they perpetrate on us. And that just really just grated my nerves just to hear that his wife behind was down there doing that sort of stuff, simply because, again, these black people are going to be conditioned to think that white people really care about us. And if nothing could be further from the truth. Thank you.
For sure, for sure. Thomas in New York, were you going to add something?
Yeah, the school set part, man, that also broke my heart, man. I mean, you know, it looked like I could imagine it just, you know, white people riding past that and just having a big chuckle, you know, like, look at this. You know, like, that's how we taught them on the plantation. You know, and with the guys that said about Brad Pitt, you know, though, let's not forget Brad Pitt is also an abductor. You know, he's very fiery racist. I mean, he even has black little black kids he's abducted. So, you know, big time racist in my book. So, no, I'll mute my line.
For sure. For sure. The documentary I said I was going to remember. It's so much stuff. Like, it just depends on how much time you want to invest. You could probably spend years going through all of the material that's associated with it, because there's so many things that you could just divert and spend, you know, 5 years researching that one particular aspect. The documentary is called A Village Called Versailles. It's the one about in New Orleans East, where these non-white people, Vietnamese, it explains how they got there, which is racism, white supremacy to begin with. And then what happened with Katrina. They have some of the footage of how bad the flooding was in this area, and them trying to come back and rebuild. And then the big controversy about the land dump that was going to be in their area, and how they and other black people worked to stop this, to get them to not dump all of this garbage and waste in this area. If you want to check it out, A Village Called Versailles. It was on PBS. I think you can watch it online, but if not, probably at your library or what have you. They tend to nab most of the PBS stuff. Anywho, we should be back. We'll be back tomorrow, 24 hours for the compensatory call-in, but this will be back next Friday, and hopefully without all the disruptions during the course of the broadcast. If you have questions or any of that, feel free to drop an email untiljustice.com. The archive should be fine. So if you want to go back and just give another listen without all the interruptions and what have you, the archive should be pristine. And thanks to all the folks who hung in, were patient, and called in, got the other information and dialed in. Thomas in New York, I think our call in Michigan, even the folks that dialed in who didn't share, I think Joy, some of the other folks, Thomas in New York, as I said, other male caller also. Thanks for being patient. I hope it was constructive, and hopefully we'll be able to do better tomorrow. But that is racism, white supremacy. Disruptions are to be expected under the system of white supremacy. Thank you kindly. We will be back tomorrow for the compensatory call-in, workplace racism, and certainly a lot of the things that have gone on over the past 7 days on the plantation. Again, if you have any problems, questions, concerns, gripes, feel free to drop an email untiljustice@gmail.com. We are on Twitter @untiljustice. With that, remain codified. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. No alcohol if you're going to be a driver, passenger, pedestrian. Buckle up every time that you are in the vehicle, and do everything you can to avoid being in the presence of intoxicated white folks, especially this weekend. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cows, signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you're so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
Man, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.